Good morning. How are y'all doing? A lot of new people here today. If it is your first time here, we are delighted to see you. Welcome to Elevate Community Church. Just in case you have been wondering, my name is George. Okay, you'll get to know me. I'm not that bad. I'm kind of nice, funny, quirky, I hope. But anyway, we have been working our way through our Hebrews series, and Hebrews has been great. We've been loving it. We've been learning all about Jesus, okay? And we're coming to the end of it. We've been doing it for the last 6 or 7 months now. We have this week, and we have next week, and then we are finally finished Hebrews. But it's been great, and we all know what it's been about. Hebrews has been about Jesus, and it's been about how great he is. The whole book has been about Jesus. And throughout this whole book and throughout the whole series that we've been doing as well, we've been making it quite clear that Christ exceeds all other people. That Christ exceeds all other pursuits, that he exceeds all other objects. That Christ exceeds all other hopes in which humanity tried to lean on. And Hebrews, what it does is that it pictures Jesus as better than the angels, as bringing better lives to humanity through salvation, and offering a better hope than the law could. And we've said time and time again throughout the book of Hebrews that what the law is any way in which you try to bridge the gap between you and God by your own means. And Hebrews, what it does throughout the whole book, it describes Jesus as providing a better inheritance in heaven for those who place their faith in him. In other words, Jesus bridges that gap between you and God. And you know, this message about Jesus, it would have been particularly important to the Christians in Rome at the time. And you may ask, well, what was so different about the Christians in Rome? And to be honest, the answer is not all that much. All the Christians in Rome were trying to figure out is, how do I be a Christian? How do I know Christ? How do I live that out in my everyday life and in my everyday culture? Now, their culture was slightly different to what we live in today. There was an emperor at the time. His name was Nero. He liked persecuting the Christians. And because of this, the Christians, they were considering moving away from Jesus and back towards the law, back towards trying to bridge the gap between themselves and God by their own means. And the writer of the book of Hebrews, he says this, he says that though they were faced with suffering, though their culture seemed more appealing, though this law might provide this immediate gratification, that they were indeed already following a better way, that Christ is better than all of the above. And so they must persevere. And that's pretty much the book of Hebrews in one paragraph. We could have saved you 6 or 7 months, but that's pretty much the whole book of Hebrews in one paragraph, okay? But what it does, okay, it leads us into Hebrews 13, okay? And Hebrews 13, it's slightly different to the rest of the book. Hebrews has been so detailed, okay? But Hebrews 13 is kind of like a phone call that won't be long enough. You know what I mean? Okay, kind of like this message. It's kind of like when you ring your mother, okay, and you're just ringing and said, oh, would you babysit, or can you pick up the kids, or can you do something like this, and you end up being on the phone for 20 minutes, and it's great, and you catch up, and you're kind of getting ready to say goodbye, and then all of a sudden your mother blurts out, don't forget about Sunday dinner on Sunday, and your sister has a new boyfriend, and it's your brother's birthday, and the cat's gone, and you need to find me a new car, and it's kind of so rushed. And that's why Hebrews 13, my mom's not like that, by the way. My mom's great. She never does that. But Hebrews 13, it's kind of hurried, okay? It's kind of like there's just so much to get out at the last moment, okay? So it's like this. The author says, hey, be hospitable to strangers and visit those who are in prison. And that's what we were talking about last week. And then it says, and guard your marriage and don't love money. Watch out for the tabernacle. It should be grace alone, just in case you forgot Hebrews 1 to 12. Should be grace alone. And let's go outside and camp with Jesus. And when you read through it, you get this real sense of urgency. As if whoever's writing it is just saying, like we just said, in case you forget everything else. In case you've just read 12 letters or 12 chapters of a letter being read out to you and you forgot it all, this is what you need to know about being a Christian. This is what you need to know about living out your everyday faith in your everyday culture. And last week, Dermot, he spoke about being hospitable as a Christian, okay? And he said this, he quoted Ashley Woolridge, and he said that information does not change anyone. It's the application of that information that changes you. And he talked about how we could even be entertaining angels and might not even realize that. And this week, we're going to be looking at Hebrews 13, verses 4 to 6, okay? And the fellow writing Hebrews, what he brings up in this passage, there are two of the things in life that can ruin you. But there are also two of the things that can make you. They happen to be two of the most idolized things on earth today, but they're also two of the most exaggerated things in the world. They're two of the things that most people that I know tend to spend their lives chasing. But they also happen to be two of the things that are the most romanticized things in the world. And what they do is they cause addiction and then disappointment, because that's what addiction will always lead to, will always lead to disappointment. So what are we talking about? Suspense is killing you, I know. Let's just jump into the passage. It's Hebrews 13, verses 4 to 6, okay? And it says this, it's going to be on the screen. By the way, we have loads of Bibles. If you don't have one, if it's your first time here, feel free to take one. They're down by the back by the notice board. They are our gift to you. Also, we recommend is it the YouVersion or the UApp? I can never remember. But it's great. They have reading plans, but you need to get one of the above. If you're not getting one of the above, it's on the screen, okay? But anyway, it reads like this. It says, marriage should be honored by all, and the marriage bed kept pure. For God would judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. For God has said, and this is going to be the main point of our message today. For God has said, never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you. So we say with confidence, the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What can mere mortals do to me? So there we go. We're talking about marriage and money, which is actually very quickly going to turn to sex and money, okay? So it's going to be a little bit awkward, okay? I find it hard too. This passage is actually about me, just in case you're wondering. Most of what I'm saying is to myself. But nevertheless. So we ask the question, why is sexual morality and the love of money, why is it talked about together? Why would the author of Hebrews talk about these two things that are so big in our lives? And why would he put them together? And the simple answer is because he's talking about you. He's talking about me. When I first met Dermot several years ago, when we began our strange relationship and friendship probably should have come first. But when we started that, okay, when he just moved home to Ireland, and I was always here, so I never left, but he had just moved home, okay, and first time I meet him, okay, he looks at me, he points at me, and he goes, money, sex, or power. And I look at him. Okay. Now, what he meant to ask was, he meant to look at me, and he meant to go, which one do you struggle with, money, sex, or power? But he was still very American back then, and so he did the point, he did the click, he looked at me, he had a shirt tucked in, he goes, money, sex, or power? And I replied, yes, please. But a lot's changed in 5 years. But my point is that money and sex are two of the things in this world that are so romanticized, that they are so powerful that everybody's going to struggle with them at some point. So why are these two things mentioned in the one passage? Because it's talking about you and I. It's talking about the things that we're really going to struggle with. So we're going to break it into two parts, the sex bit and the money bit. And we'll start with the sex bit, okay? Dermot's always giving me hard topics. Normally I get predestination or some weird theology we don't understand, but no, this time he gives me sex and money. But anyway, verse 4, marriage should be honored by all, and the marriage bed, by the way, the marriage bed, that being sex, kept pure. For God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral. So let me explain this, okay? It sounds really, really harsh. But I just want to explain the practical way this works out. I'm talking about marriage. I'm not giving practical advice on sex. We're talking about marriage, okay? Now, what he says here, he says, okay, in the world, loving on a stranger giving back to the oppressed, all the things that Dermot talked about last week, okay? While you are doing this, you must guard and you must contend for the health of your marriage. And he's bringing this up. He's bringing this up because marriage is difficult. You have to contend for it. Contend means to fight for it. You have to prioritize. You have to prioritize it. If that's the only start I get in this message, it'll be a miracle, okay? But marriage is always going to be something that you have to be working at. Whether you're celebrating 30 years like Barney Ruth, congratulations. It is 30 years, right? Congratulations. Rock stars, okay? Such role models, okay? But whether you are there celebrating 30 years of marriage, or whether you're just getting started, whether you just said I do and you're kind of figuring out, is this my pillow or is it her pillow? Whether you're there, or whether you're in the stage where you're courting and you're getting engaged and you're thinking about marriage and you're thinking, is this the person that I'm going to spend the rest of my life with? Or you might even just be at the stage and saying, oh, there's a pretty girl. If you're at the pretty girl stage, you need to go to the Love and Respect conference, okay? Or you might be saying, oh, there is a pretty guy. But hopefully if you're a lady and you see a guy, you're kind of saying, he's handsome, not pretty, but a handsome guy, okay? But no matter what stage you are, wherever you are, whether you're contemplating, whether you're doing it 30 years, whether you're just getting going, marriage is hard. And what you have to strive towards in marriage is this, okay? The Jews say, Ahava and Shalom. I think I'm pronouncing it right. It sounds like the Lion King. But Ahava and Shalom. And it means love and peace. Okay? And there is more behind these words. There is joy. There is passion. There's this longing for more. Did you ever just see somebody who really loves their spouse? And I mean, like, cringy, movie-like, really loves their spouse. And you're kind of just left there with your jaw hitting the ground, and you're going, wow. You ever just see that? And I can tell you now that there is an unbelievable amount of power in a man who passionately works to love his wife deeply and to be faithful to her. Or did you ever see a woman who loves her husband with such 100% respect that she would give up absolutely everything just to love her husband more? And I can honestly, yeah, he says, and I can honestly say there's nothing more attractive, for me as a man, there's nothing more attractive than a loving wife. And I'm glad I have one. I have the greatest wife, because otherwise I'll just be walking around lusting after other marriages. But I have a really great wife. Sarah's the best wife ever. And this is what it's supposed to look like. Marriage is supposed to look like, look how much they love each other. Look how much they go out of their way for each other. That's what marriage is supposed to look like. Marriage was never supposed to be captioned by a ball and chain. You're supposed to look at marriage and be more like, yes, it frees me. Marriage gives me wings, it makes me fly, it makes me do the impossible. My marriage frees me up so much. But the thing is, today, when you describe marriage this way, it seems kind of odd. You expect somebody to say, oh yeah, my spouse is the ball and chain. You never expect to hear somebody say, well, it's great, it's fantastic, you got to do it. And the thing is, it seems odd today. And you know, at one point, nearly 60% of Christian marriages ended in divorce. And it's actually a lot better now. I was reading a blog during the week, they called it the divorce boom. It seems to be over. In 2016, there was approximately a 13% divorce rate. So you look at this and you're kind of like, huh, that's not so bad when you say 60% first. But you look at this, okay? Statistically speaking, back 10, 20, 30 years ago, a child's biggest fear was being afraid of the dark, or being afraid of falling over, or being afraid of getting hurt. Today, statistically speaking, a child's biggest fear is one of their parents having to leave. And part of the reason that this is so is that we've just become so okay with divorce as a society, as if it's just not a big deal. But the thing is, you compare the world's current view of marriage, you compare what we just described to our current situations at the beginning of verse 4, where it says, yes, we're still in the beginning of verse 4, where it says, marriage should be honored by all. It's very different to the way the world views it. And you must contend. You must fight for your marriage. And this is one of the only places where I might dare say, yes, your marriage should be a competition. You should compete to be the best spouse possible. You should compete to be the best husband possible, the best wife possible. And you know what? That actually applies to you even if you haven't found the one yet. Okay, now I want you to write this down. If you're single and you're here this morning, everybody actually needs to write this down, okay? If you were here this morning and there is a the one or a potential the one in your life, you need to write this down, okay? We coined this a couple of years ago when we were doing our relationship series. It's stuck with me ever since, okay? It's gonna be up here, okay? It says, be the person that the person you are looking for is looking for. I know, it's a tongue twister. We'll say it again. Be the person that the person you are looking for is looking for. And I was once asked the question, would you date somebody like you? And of course I said, yeah. But would you date somebody like you? And what the person was trying to actually ask me was, we have all these standards that we've built up in our head for what we want the one to be like or what they're supposed to be like. So how do you compare to your own standards for the one? Are you the person that the person you are looking for is looking for? Or are you guilty of double standards? Or a better way of putting it, a more blunt way of putting it, are you guilty of lazy love? Marriage happens to be one of the main things that reflects the love, mercy, and pursuit of Jesus for us. And this, when it mentions this judgment thing, okay? The judgment thing is just saying that when you don't contend for your marriage, when you don't fight for your marriage, when you don't work your hardest at your marriage, and it explodes, and it doesn't work out, and it falls apart, there is deep pain. And I know we have a lot of divorced people who go to church, and we have a lot of people here who are divorced, but they will tell you how bad that pain is, what it's like when everything starts to fall apart. And the thing is, that's why I love grace so much. That's why I love Jesus so much. Because even in the deep pain, even when it seems like everything is falling apart, Jesus is still there with his arms wide open saying, never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you. And the author is saying, listen, pain always comes with this. When you don't honor marriage, pain always follows. And he's not talking about the sense of abuse or things like that, because that's always going to be painful. But that's expectedly painful. What he's saying is where, what he's saying is where marriage isn't fought for, where it isn't contended for, where it isn't worked out, where your marriage isn't given to, where it isn't your priority, where marriage is not honored, there's heartbreak and suffering. And this brings us to the next part of the first verse. We're going to be here a while. This brings us to the next part of the first verse where it says, the marriage bed, and again, that is sex. But the marriage bed is to be kept pure. For God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral. And here's the thing about the marriage bed. I said earlier I wasn't giving practical advice about sex, but I'm going to give one piece, okay? You may want to write this down, all the married and all the single people as well. With the marriage bed, with sex, if you're going to do it right. I really wanted to get the Wham song for the intro today, but apparently it's still copyrighted. If you want to do it right. No. Sex has a proper place, okay, and that is within marriage. The passage says that sex is to be kept pure and that God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral. Now, this is a topic that we could spend an entire series on, but if we go too much into it today, which I'd love to, not really, but if we went too much into it today, we'd miss the whole point of today's passage, okay? But I'll say this. Sexual immorality... Every time I practice this, I said sexual immortality. But sexual immorality is anything we do sexually that is not what God has intended or God has designed for sex. The word sexual immorality in the Bible is the word porneia. Sound familiar? Yeah, maybe. And in the Bible, Galatians 5 in particular, it shows that it covers a multitude of sexual acts. And the Bible also makes one other thing clear, though. The Bible teaches that marriage between a man and a woman is the proper place for sex. That right there, that is where sex is appropriate. That is where it is beautiful. That's where it was designed to be. And you know what? You can turn and say, well, George, you're going to turn around and say that sex is just for procreation. No, I'm not. But sex does lead to children, just in case anybody missed that class. Okay? It does go there, okay? Okay, God. Is this the land? No. There we go. No? Again? No, we're back. Okay. That was awkward. God created our bodies to enjoy sex, okay? And I'll tell you right now, I have two beautiful sons. I have the best kids ever, Lucas and Ruben. You see them, they're running around before service. They're destroying the place. I love them so much. They're the best things ever, okay? But for where I am in life, sex right now, it isn't about making more babies, if you know what I mean. It's about me and my wife. It's about our marriage. It's about our loving each other. It's about our intimacy. And it's about living out our marriage the way that God has intended us to. The next part of the passage, it says, keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. And you look at this passage, keep your lives free from the love of feeling, the love of money, and be content with what you have. And I read it, and it leaves me with just one question. How do you obey a command to feel a certain way? Love, it's a feeling. It's a craving. He's talking about craving money. How do you obey a command not to feel a feeling? And it's interesting how the author here, he goes from saying how we are to love in marriage, but then he goes on to say, be careful you don't love money. He's going from talking about an appropriate way to love versus an inappropriate way to love. But you see, the thing is, it has to do with this word content in the passage, okay? Quite often, love or craving, what it does is that it causes anxiety or fear. Because when you love something, when you crave something, when you need it so bad, all of a sudden, the fear kicks in. Well, what if it doesn't work out? What if it's not going to work? What if it's going to leave me hurt? And this fear and anxiety would kick in. And in this anxiety, you start asking yourself, what if my marriage is not enough for me? And then you start depending on your marriage for immediate gratification, which makes you ask, why does the sex feel so empty? Why does our love feel so empty? Why is this just bleh every day? And then what you do is, when that happens, you move on to the other fulfilling thing in your life, your money, your wealth, your riches. And you fall in love with that and you crave it so much so that it's all you think about. You end up lusting over money the same way you lust after sex. And the pastor says, don't do that. It says to be content. So what does this word content mean? Content means to be in a state of peaceful happiness. It means to satisfy, both in the noun and the verb, the noun when you are satisfied and the verb when you are to satisfy. And to be content is to be healthy. In fact, content is actually the perfect opposite to anxiety. And we're reading this passage, and inside I'm saying, and I know you guys are saying too, you say, but God, look all around me. Sex is romanticized. Marriage is romanticized. It's exaggerated. Look at all the money. How am I supposed to be content? And it's all around me, and I feel like I'm told that I need it, that I have to have it, and so much so that your whole life becomes about needing it. Well, then, you see, the thing is that we see this tiny little word in the passage, just one itty-bitty little word, the word for. Whenever you see the word for, by the way, in the Bible, okay, that means something big is about to happen, okay? That means that whoever's writing it is going to, he's been saying A, B, C, and D, and then he's going to hit you with E, okay? So we see this word for in the passage, okay? This is where our passage shifts. It shifts from talking about the things that are currently important to you and I, the things that in everyday life you kind of chase after. And it shifts and it starts to talking about what should be important, what should be important in our everyday life. So let's read it. I'll just look over the whole passage quickly again. It says, marriage should be honored by all, and the marriage bed kept pure, for God would judge the adulterer and the sexually immoral. Keep your lives free from the love of money, and be content with all you have, for God has said, there's the four, God has said, and here's the main point of the message again, never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you. And all of a sudden, content looks, it looks a whole lot different to what we thought it was. And all these things that we build our lives around, the pastors will talk about marriage, sex, and money, but it can be anything. You can build your life around anything. It can be your career, your identity, your relationships, your opinion, anything that we expect to satisfy us. And the passage is saying, don't worry about them. It's not saying don't enjoy them. It's saying don't worry about them. And you turn around and say, but my marriage is failing and I can't stop these immoral acts and I never seem to have much money. And Jesus, he just replies and he says, never will I leave you. But God, my spouse just left. Never will I leave you. But God, I can't live with this guilt of my sex life, my sexuality. Never will I leave you. I just lost my home. Never will I leave you. My job, my career, it's not working out the way I thought it would. Never would I leave you. I'm not the person that I thought I was. Never would I leave you. My opinions, they're changing. What I thought is important isn't important anymore, and I don't know what to do. Never would I leave you. I'm sick. Never would I leave you. And you see, when we read this passage, we seem to get caught up on the big words. We get caught up on the marriage bit, the sex bit, the money bit. And the reason is that the reason why we do this is because they have become the most important things to us in life. But the whole point of these few verses, it's so simple. It's Jesus saying that in all this, never will I leave you. So what happens if we turn to Jesus? What happens if we surrender to Jesus? What happens if we give Jesus control of our marriage, of our finances? Let's read the last verse. So we say with confidence, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What can mere mortals do to me? And the first thing we see here in this passage, so we say. And the word here, it's the same as the word preach, but it's about preaching to yourself. Did you ever just hear a sermon and it changed your life? Kind of like this one? That's what the verse is saying. It says to preach to yourself with confidence. To preach to yourself with complete faith and complete trust in Christ. So we say, the Lord is my helper. I'm not afraid. What can mere man do to me? And here's what we take from this one sentence. There's a few things in it. The first is that we have God's promised presence in our life. Never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. The second is, the Lord is my helper. So when you can't do it on your own, and God knows you can't do it on your own, the Lord is my helper. We know that man, what anybody says to you, can't actually ruin your relationship with God, that we don't have to fear, that we can be free from this love and craving, and that we can become content, that in Christ, when we subject ourselves to him, that we can be without worry. So I'm going to finish with this. Jesus loves you. And he wants the best for you. He wants you to be the best possible version of yourself. And so when it comes to your marriage, he wants you to have the best marriage. When it comes to your finances, he wants you to have the best finances. When it comes to all of the above, no matter what it is, when it comes to that, whether it's sex, whether it's your job, whether it's your kids, whatever it is, whatever is holding you in anxiety, whatever is holding you in fear, Jesus says, I want the best for you. He doesn't want you to experience the bad in them. There are all things that God has created for you to enjoy. So I say, what other choice do we have other than to surrender to Christ? So we surrender. Pray with me. God, you are so great and your grace is so beautiful and so needed. God, we just pray as we reflect on this passage throughout the week, Lord, that no matter what our circumstances are, that we would see the truth in you never leaving us. I pray that we'd understand that comfort, that peace. I pray, God, that we would know you more. And I pray that in every anxiety and every fear we have, we return to you and your love. It's in your name we pray. Amen.